Okay, here's a historical quiz. What is the one thing that you know about President William Howard Taft? Come on, one thing that you know about President William Howard Taft. And no, he did not get stuck in his own bathtub. Is it a shame that there are some presidents you just don't know a whole heck of a lot about? Well, I certainly have always felt that way about President Taft. And so recently, when I was in Cincinnati, I made a point of going to the Taft National Historic Site, along with my son Tom. And now you can join me as we go through and learn all about this elusive early 20th century president. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about Will Taft.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
If you know anything about Cincinnati, anything about the political history of Cincinnati, also known, incidentally, as the Queen City on the banks of the Ohio River, then you can't avoid the Taft family. The name Taft is still prominent there. There's the Taft Art Museum, which is the old Taft family private art collection that's all been held together and is now just on display downtown. There's a Taft law firm, which is still very prominent within that city and indeed in the country. And of course, there's the legacy of the family itself. Its most prominent member is a fellow we're going to be talking about today, President William Howard Taft. But he's not the only Taft. There was Senator Robert Taft, later very prominent in mid-20th century America. And there are many, many other Tafts who have served in various offices all throughout the state of Ohio, if not the nation. But Taft, as familiar as it is in Cincinnati, is not necessarily a name that's familiar to a lot of people outside the great state of Ohio. I was aware of President William Howard Taft, but I was primarily aware of him in the way that many amateur students of American history are, and that is as the guy who was between Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. I mean, and that's a tough place to be. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt, everybody knows about Teddy Roosevelt, who served basically from 1901 to about 1909. And everybody knows about Woodrow Wilson, who served from 1913 all the way to about 1920, when at the end of the First World War and the Treaty of Versailles and all of that. But who was the guy who was in office from 1909 until 1913? That's William Howard Taft. But kind of like John Adams, who came between George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, Taft gets overlooked. And if he's not overlooked, he's denigrated because he's a big fat guy. And we like to make fun of big fat guys, don't we? And so if you've heard anything about President William Howard Taft, it's probably that he got stuck in his bathtub. And that's not even true. So this is a long overdue episode where we're going to get the real skinny, no pun intended, on President William Howard Taft straight from a fellow at the Taft Historic Site. His name is Dennis Solovsky. On a bright, clear, cold January day, Dennis took me and my elder son, Tom, on a tour of the Taft home. And he started by telling me about Alfonso Taft, who is the father of President William Howard Taft.
Alfonso Taft, the president's father, is a New Englander by birth. He comes from Connecticut, and his family were farmers back east. And Alfonso's father, though, actually worked in the Vermont legislature and was a local justice of the peace, but they had the means to send Alfonso to Yale. Mm. So the president's father gets a college education. He becomes a lawyer by rote, was back with his family, and starts his own family in Vermont. And then one day he wakes up and says to himself, you know, I don't want to end up like my parents in the middle of nowhere. So he picked everybody up, including mom and dad, and brings them all here to Cincinnati. This is the sixth largest city in the nation. 40,000 people live here, and he believes he'll get a good law practice started in the city. Mm-hmm. Now, in addition to his parents, he also brings with him a very strong conservative New England Yankee Baptist value system. And the Yankee frugality is reflected in this house. You notice the woodwork is all faux finished. Soft pine, paint it, comb it, make it look like an expensive wood. Houses this size might have had a tile entryway. They put oilcloth down and paint it to look like tile.
Huh.
The fireplaces on the first floor are wood, slate, or cast iron. The slate and cast iron ones are painted to look like marble. So the Tafts like nice things. They just don't like wasting their money. Where this family spends their money and time is on education and travel. That's key to this household. Now, as we go through the house, you'll notice we have very few Taft items. They didn't collect possessions. They weren't possession-conscious people. But what we do have are their letters, their diaries, and their inventories. Grandpa's job here was to take care of the property. He kept a very detailed log of everything he did to the structure. I bought yellow paint for the exterior. I bought wood to build a cupboard. I bought bricks to reline a cistern. He also kept lists of things the family owned, including books, magazines, and newspapers. Now, Mrs. Taft, she left family back east. She wrote her sisters very detailed letters of how each room was appointed. I bought this lamp and set it on that table in the corner of this room next to this chair with this color drapery. So based on this information, the Park Service has been able to replicate the rooms with period Cincinnati furniture. We do have a few Taft items, and I'll point those out as we go through the house. Now, the wallpaper on the first floor is all reproduction of what the Park Service found during the restoration work of the house.
Well, that's very nifty. So you're pretty sure this is the sort that was up. Okay.
Yep, yep.
Very nice. Now, this, I'm just going to give my own impression here. Now, this is not what you'd call a grand entrance hall. This is much more of a functional entrance hall, isn't it?
Yeah, the Tafts were very functional people. Mm-hmm. They weren't possession conscious. I mean, if they wanted something to sell, they just put it on the front porch and sold it. If somebody down the street had something for sale, they'd go up to that house and buy it off the front porch.
Huh.
And possessions didn't mean much to them. They were really a hand-to-mouth economy back then. Alfonso made good money, but he spent it too.
Okay.
Okay, we're going to go to the first room. Now, one of the things you have to remember about this house is this is not the president's house. This is his father's house. But it's in this house the president is born, raised, 18 years of his life are spent here. This is where his character and his value system are established. And it's primarily due to the fact that he has a large extended family to influence him. The family highly values education. And then with this comes his commitment to public service. Now, as I mentioned, Alfonso moved in 1851. He has his wife, Fanny. He's got his parents, Sylvia and Peter Taft. He's got two little boys, Charlie and Peter. And in this house, you know, it's a family atmosphere, but the sad part about it is a year into this, moving into the house, his wife dies. Fanny dies of consumption of lungs and brains, tuberculosis. Alfonso needs a mother for his boys. He needs a wife, a mistress of the house. So that year, he goes back to New England, specifically wife hunting. And he has a relationship with the family.
Well, they've got some nice women up there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And he has a relationship with a family in Massachusetts named the Torys, and they have a daughter. Her name is Louisa Marie. She is 17 years younger than Alfonso, but she's already in the spinsterhood. She's 24 and unmarried.
Oh, my goodness.
But she's educated, teaches school, plays piano. She's a handsome woman. Mm-hmm. Alfonso meets her, courts her, marries her in a couple months, and brings Louise back to Cincinnati. Now, when she walks through the front doors waiting for her are these two little boys and in-laws who have never met her. The children accept Louise as their mother in the first couple months, and she accepts these boys as her true sons. Grandpa likes Louise because she's good New England stock. Now, she becomes pregnant the first year, gives birth to a little boy. He only lives 13 months. Typhoid, diphtheria, a childhood disease takes him. She becomes pregnant again, and on September 15, 1857, she gives birth to William Howard. He's a happy, hearty, healthy baby boy. We have a photo here of Louise with Will at one, Will at 10.
He was a cutie pie.
And then one of the few photos of the house from that time period, and that's the photo that's used for the restoration of the exterior of the house. If you look closely, there's a 10-year-old future president standing up against the fence in the front yard.
Very nice.
Now, the room we are in was primarily Grandma and Grandpa's bedchamber. Rooms changed function over the years as people came and went. For my story, this is their room. And I've often thought if my grandparents had lived with me, it would have been Grandma, tell me a story, Grandpa, tell me a story. Well, the grandparents also have this strong value system, and the stories they tell are going to reflect that. One of the methods they use to tell stories is with these Chinese export tiles around the fireplace. Each tile tells us a different story. We have biblical stories, Shakespeare, French fairy tales, and Aesop's fables. Of course, the most famous one is the fourth one up on the right, Tortoise and the Hare. Slow and steady always gets the prize.
Right.
It's a lesson Will learns well because the prize in his life is not the presidency. It is the court, the Supreme Court. This is a man, before he is president, has an opportunity to sit on the Supreme Court three times, and he lets it pass by. One, he wasn't ready to go to the court and wanted to finish his current job assignments. But the second reason was his wife, Helen. She did not want him on the bench. She wanted him in the White House. So every time a career change comes up, she's kind of directing him towards the White House. As president, Mr. Taft has to appoint more men to the Supreme Court than any other sitting president. Outside of
George, each time he wishes he was appointing himself.
Yeah, other than George Washington, who appoints the entire first court.
Right, right.
And Franklin Roosevelt, 30 years later, appoints 9 men in 12 years. Mm-hmm. Mr. Taft has to appoint 6 men in 4 years to the job he really wanted.
Yeah, that's an interesting constitutional question. I wonder if a president could appoint himself. I've never really thought about that. I guess if he could get confirmed, you'd have to assume that.
You know, he does a couple things different than previous presidents, uh-huh. though. One, he's the first president to promote an associate justice to the chief justice job, Edmund mm-hmm. White. Secondly, he appoints 2 Democrats, 2 Southerners, and 2 Catholics. So he's actually breaking the mold. But he's also, his litmus test for the time was about the law. And the law was all written about property rights. Mm-hmm. So that was his litmus test, you know, protecting people's property rights, not civil rights or anything else. Time was about property rights.
Mm-hmm. Very important.
And he's also looking at the age of his associates because he still has in the back of his mind someday.
I want a bunch of old fat guys and they'll all die, so they'll be.
Exactly.
Before we leave that, though, you said break the mold. And the mold up to that time had been white, Eastern, Protestant, prosperous, powerful lawyers and others.
And you'd go to your senator from that state and say, right. who do you want on the
right.
court? And he would, you know, make that. But Taft did not ask for any help. He picked people he knew.
It's actually really rather interesting. Right now, the court is made up of 6 Catholics and 3 Jews. I think that's the makeup.
I believe you're right.
Yeah, it is. And I mention that because it was only recently for the first time, we don't have a single Protestant on the Supreme Court. And that is quite a shift from this era that mm-hmm. you're talking about, where everybody basically looked the same, was from the
yes.
same background.
Yes. Yes.
So he was already sort of diversifying because Catholics, of course, mm-hmm. were disfavored back then.
Right.
And he was also crossing party lines.
And he's also bringing Southerners to the court because he's still yeah. talking about uniting the country after the war.
The Civil War. Right, exactly.
Civil
Very
war.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The portrait on the wall that we have hanging here is mm-hmm. a portrait of the president in 1909.
Right.
He's the first president to leave the country while in office. He crossed the border from El Paso, Texas, into Mexico for only 4 hours to negotiate a treaty. And to commemorate that event, President Diaz of Mexico had this portrait done, and we have it hanging here today.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the president also has a summer vacation home at Murray Bay on the St. Lawrence River in Quebec, Canada. He never went there the 4 years he was in office because it meant leaving the country.
That's right. And although that's not prohibited, it was certainly disfavored for
yeah.
a long time.
Now, people will argue with me. Roosevelt had left the country, but he went to Panama and Cuba, which were U.S. territories. So, there's a fine
right.
line there about what about what was leaving the country. And, of course, after Taft leaves office, Wilson goes off to Europe to
right.
negotiate the Treaty of Versailles.
But that was a big deal.
It was a big deal because yeah. of communications.
Right.
You didn't know what would happen.
Well, one big issue, and this was even the later Roosevelt, FDR, is that you basically got 10 days to sign a law or veto it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if Congress is acting while the president's gone, you've got to be able to sign that original document and get it back in time or not. And that was typically cited during FDR's term as a major, major issue whenever he was going to those conferences. So one can see why you wouldn't want to leave the country and why he wouldn't go to Quebec.
I did not know that.
Yeah, that's why. I mean, it's an issue. I mean, there's no
yeah.
actual prohibition in the Constitution.
Right.
Presidents can go where they want to go. But if Congress does something in the meantime, Congress might get away with a lot in a president's absence.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got to keep a careful watch on that. Yeah. Much easier to do today with Air Force One and all the rest of it.
Yes.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week we're learning all about that overlooked and often denigrated president, William Howard Taft, courtesy of Dennis Solovsky and the good people at the Taft National Historic Site in Cincinnati, Ohio. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll continue our tour. Now it's time for a quiz with the quiz prez, the president of James Madison University, John Alger.
Who are you?
My name's Lewis.
Lewis. And where are you from, Lewis?
I'm from Fairfax, Virginia.
Really? Okay. And I'm guessing you're a student here.
Yes, that's correct.
And you're a very tall student, so you're having to bend over every time. I'm sorry about that.
No, it's no problem. I'm used to it.
Okay, tremendous. Well, you're young. You can bend like that. And what are you majoring in, Lewis?
I'm majoring in political science.
Okay, political science. I detect a pattern here. Don't we have any gym majors or anything like that? Okay, I guess we won't do that. Okay.
All right.
What do you got for Lewis, quiz prez?
Okay, so this is a question about what's not in the Constitution. Which of the following is not mentioned in the Constitution? A, trial by jury. B, public education. C, protections for life, liberty, or property. And D, how the president should be chosen. So which is not mentioned in the Constitution?
I really want to go with B, public education.
B is public education.
Okay, clearly the problem here is that your professors are teaching your students too much. And they're making it too difficult for us to stump them. Mm-hmm. Because I'm going to guess, quiz press, what's the correct answer?
The correct answer is, in fact, B, public education.
Well done, Lewis. Now,
I don't know what you think, Stuart, but I have to say, this is one of the questions that, for me, when I think about what I think ought to be in the Bill of Rights and what other nations have, there is, in other constitutions, a recognition that education is vital to a democracy. And our Supreme Court has stopped short of saying that public education is a fundamental right. And to me, when you think about voting and participating as a citizen, especially now, in the 21st century, that education is vital. So I would look back on this and say, you know, at the time, education perhaps didn't play quite the same role that it does today. But if I were there, I would certainly have tried to argue for this. And certainly today, if we were writing the Constitution, I think there'd be a strong argument that education underlies the ability to exercise a lot of other rights.
Today, Bill took me on a campus tour. And by the way, what a gorgeous campus. The Bluestone, it's just a gorgeous place. And I was in a tunnel, and I saw something on that tunnel wall. I believe it was a quote, "Knowledge shall forever govern ignorance." That's straight from James Madison, and it just buttresses exactly what the quiz prez just told us. You can't have a functioning democratic republic without knowledge and education. You can't do it. In fact, Jefferson had a really good quote on that, too. That I don't recall the details of. It's absolutely true. Now, here's the interesting thing. You don't even have to look at other nations to find constitutions that guarantee public education. In fact, there's a huge case right now pending in Kansas, I think it is, because the Kansas Constitution guarantees a certain right to public education, and I believe that the Kansas Supreme Court declared the state in violation of that provision, and therefore there has this big debate now. What has to be done? Do they have to raise taxes in order to do this or not? And I think maybe that's the reason our Supreme Court has never found it to be a fundamental right, because it has immediate and direct taxing implications. If someone goes in and says, you know, you're not giving me a public education, does that mean the Supreme Court's going to be setting tax rates? And I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm saying I think that's their hesitation.
The presidential one that almost weighs a quarter ton. 6'2" or 330 pounds. Who is the dude with the golf and Neptune attitude? Can you put it? Who's the prez that just picks out when there's good food all about? Chow on. They say this cat Taft is a bad muncher.
Shut your pie hole!
Just talking about Taft.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today we're on a tour of the Taft National Historic Site in Cincinnati, Ohio, the ancestral home of the prominent political Taft family of Cincinnati, whose most prominent member, both in terms of political stature and in terms of physical size, was President William Howard Taft. Now, the impression I'm getting, you know, I'm not an architect, what you've got here is a very significant central hall right down the middle of this big square house.
Correct.
And lots of rooms opening off to
right.
the side.
The
with
original
lots of
house is four rooms on the first floor, four rooms on the second floor, which would have been all bed chambers upstairs.
Right.
And downstairs would have been the parlor, the dining room, the library, and then another bed chamber.
And
with the addition, which we're in now, on the first floor, he adds two large bedrooms and four more rooms upstairs for the staff, the servants of the house.
Right.
And his growing family.
I'm just kind of wondering about the layout, because you don't have a sense that there's, and we haven't been through the whole house yet, so maybe I'll have a different impression later. But right now you've got this central hallway with a bunch of relatively small rooms, each of which has a fairly substantial door leading to it.
Mm-hmm.
Was that to help keep things warm in the wintertime? Was there a particular reason for that, or was it just the style?
I think it was just the style of the architecture for
okay.
the time. I mean, we're on Auburn Avenue in Cincinnati, and Auburn Avenue was the fifth avenue of Cincinnati in its day.
Oh, yeah, there's some pretty impressive houses
here. Lived
yeah.
here on this street.
Right.
There's 14 homes remaining from the time period, and they're all have been converted to other uses, multifamily units or office facilities for the medical center across the street.
Hmm. All right.
We're in the nursery of the house right now. We know all the children slept in this room. The older stepbrothers we know shared a double bed. Little Will may have been in the crib about the same time. Now, Charlie, his older brother, is 14 years older than Will, but they become really true brothers, best friends, confidants throughout their lives. All the children go to public school. Hamilton County, number 16, is two blocks to the northeast. The structure back there today is the William Howard Taft Elementary School. All the boys go to the old Woodward High School down in the basin. Will graduates second in his class. Dad went to Yale. All the boys go to Yale, get their college education. They all become lawyers, come back to town. Now, Charlie, his older brother, he does eventually serve a term in Congress and a term at the State House in Columbus. But he meets Anna Sinton. And Anna is the daughter of David Sinton, one of the wealthiest men in the Midwest. David made his money monopolizing the pig iron industry during the Civil War. But he's also involved with real estate, transportation, and publishing. Charlie marries his daughter, Anna, and goes into business with David. And they eventually buy the Cincinnati Times-Star, which becomes the Republican newspaper for this area. They also help develop one of the first wire service systems in the country, where they can print a story here and send it out across the telegraphic wires for republication, kind of the internet of the day.
High tech.
High tech. David Sinton dies in 1900. He leaves his entire estate, estimated between $15 to $20 million, to his only child, Anna. It makes her one of the wealthiest women in the country.
Excuse me, Dennis, I have to interrupt here, and I'm going to turn it over to my son, Tom. Tom, when you get married, marry a really rich woman like this, okay? Got that? You're learning this lesson?
Sure.
Okay, thank you.
Noted.
Okay.
It makes Anna one of the wealthiest women in the country. Now, Charlie and Anna are astute business people, and they build on this fortune, but they also became very generous. They supported many social, cultural organizations in the city. They supported many Republicans for office, but they also treated themselves to a wonderful art collection. They bought Rembrandt, Turner, Whistler, Gainsborough, the finest Chinese porcelains money can buy, and they opened their house up for citizens to come in and learn about this art. And when they died, they left their home and collection to the city. Today, it's the Taft Museum of Art, downtown on Pike Street, collection intact.
Wow.
William, same path, Yale, lawyer. He has a 50-year career. In that 50 years, only a year and a half are in private law practice. The other 48 years, he works for the county, the state, the federal government. He does not have a great income working for the government. Charlie, though, has resources to supplement Will's lifestyle with a check every year for $6,000, $7,000, $8,000. Will runs for president in 1908. He refuses to take campaign contributions from corporations. He doesn't want to be indebted to them in the White House. Charlie writes a check for the 1908 campaign to the tune of $600,000.
Good heavens. And that's in 1908.
That's 1908 dollars.
Oh, man, that's a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, he's loaded. I mean, he's
right.
got money to boot. Now, Charlie dies in Cincinnati, New Year's Eve, 1929. He's 84. He's been sick for several years. William is 72, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, living in D.C., and his health hasn't been great the last couple months. Will's doctors advise him not to go to Cincinnati in January for his brother's funeral because his health wasn't good. He doesn't listen, though. He comes to Charlie's funeral. He goes back to Washington, resigns the court February 3rd, dies March 8th, 2 months after his older brother. Both elderly and sick, but I believe there was an emotional bond between the two that facilitates that early demise.
Yeah, may very well have.
Yeah. Now, after Will, Louise has two more sons, Henry and Horace. Same path, Yale, lawyers. Henry, though, goes off to New York City, opens his own law firm that deals with the corporations and railroads that Will won't take money from. He, though, becomes a bigwig in New York State Republican Party politics, and his law partner, George Wickersham, becomes Attorney General of the United States under his brother, Will.
Right.
Now, Horace doesn't like being an attorney. He gives up the profession, and he goes into education. With his older brother Charlie's financial help, he opens a school for boys in Watertown, Connecticut, called the Taft School. All subsequent generations of Taft children attend the school, but they get a very liberal education. The school still exists today at the College Quad Prep School, and I believe tuition this year is $52,000.
Good heavens.
That includes room and board.
Well, okay, well then there's that. I guess quite a deal then, right?
Yeah, the final child born to Alfonso and Louise is a little girl. And in honor of Alfonso's first wife, Louise names her Frances. Fanny, as she is called by the family, has this room all to herself. The boys have either moved upstairs or out of the house. Charlie is 23 years older than his little sister. Now, at age 4, she becomes very sick at Christmas and can't leave this room to celebrate. So the boys come in and they hang a Christmas tree from the ceiling and decorate it with candy paper ornaments so that she can be part of the festivities. So you can see this is a family that love and support each other in just about everything that they do. And if you would have came last week, we would have had the Christmas tree still
hanging.
Oh, really?
Still, just took it all down. I see the hook.
They just took all the decorations down in the last couple of days.
Now, hanging it from the ceiling, was that a tradition then?
I have no idea.
I have no idea either. I guess I've never heard of it,
but it makes a nice story in this room.
It's a great story. Okay.
Yeah. We also have one of the fireplaces in this room that are painted rather ornately. Mm-hmm. Alfonso does not burn wood in any of the fireplaces. He installs coal stoves, more efficient, cleaner to operate. Mrs. Taft has servants. They're usually Irish, German immigrant girls that only lasted about a year. We've learned Mrs. Taft was a difficult woman to work for.
Oh.
Although she had one of the girls sleeping here with the children at night, there's a trundle bed that would have been wheeled out for her to sleep in. After the children vacate this room, Alfonso and Louise take over this bedroom, and Alfonso writes in his diary how cozy this room is.
It's cozy now.
Yeah.
It's nice and warm in here on a very cold January day.
It's a nice sunshine shining for it.
Yes, it is.
We're going to leave this room and go back to the front of the house.
Okay.
Now, growing up in the neighborhood, the boys are rather large and energetic children. Will becomes their largest president. 6'1", 335 pounds. But even as a child, his nickname is Lubber, or Big Lub. Henry's just called Lub, and Horace is called Little Lub. The boys are very athletic, though. Baseball is their game. They're a member of gangs in the neighborhood, but the gangs back then were all baseball teams.
Ah.
The children love to sled down Sycamore Hill. It's a half-mile straight shot to the basin.
We just walked up Sycamore Hill.
You walked up Sycamore Hill?
That would be a very good sledding hill.
Yes. But it was stopped when the mothers ban it because too many bones are being broken.
Right.
Will also loves to box and wrestle. And we know this because the neighborhood boys wrote that they used him to settle their disputes. And we know he wasn't judicial. This is the library of the house. As I mentioned, education is key in this household. Mom is a former school teacher. She demanded excellence out of her children. The boys would sit around the table in the evening and read books out loud to each other and study together. Now, the president's father, Alfonso, has a noted national career in his own right. One, he's got the best library on the street. The books in the bookcases represent the books he would have had because Grandpa kept a list and the Park Service has been able to replicate the library. I mentioned Alfonso's a graduate of Yale. He's a founding member of Skull and Bone, and we have their membership books in the bookcases, and each of the books are missing the rites and rituals of the organization, so we still don't know how to get into it.
That's a big secret, I guess. Yeah.
Locally, Alfonso is an abolitionist. He takes Charlie across the river during the Civil War to help build fortifications for the defense of Cincinnati. Alfonso also hires a free African-American to work with him in his law practice. This gentleman, George Washington Williams, becomes the first black representative at the State House in Columbus. Locally, he's a founding member of the Ohio Republican Party. He attends the first national conference in 1856 in Philadelphia and the second one in 1860 in Chicago, which nominates Lincoln. Alfonso does not support Lincoln. He supports Salmon Chase of Ohio.
Right.
Lincoln's not an abolitionist yet, totally, but Chase was.
This was a hotbed of abolitionism,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yes, Cincinnati is the most southern northern city in the Union. So this was a city that was torn, you know, between the two issues.
Right.
And the Ohio River, you know, is the borderline for slaves to cross over.
And Salmon Chase was from here.
And Salmon Chase was from Ohio. In fact,
exactly right.
He's buried over in Spring Grove Cemetery with many of the Taft family.
We're going to have to do an episode on him sometime. He's a fascinating character, and if people want to read about him, there's a great character sketch of him in that wonderful Doris Kearns Goodman book, Team of Rivals.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
But anyway.
Very good. Anyways. Locally, Alfonso's a judge. He sits on the Cincinnati Superior Court. He's highly regarded and well-respected until he writes an opinion that keeps the Bible out of public schools.
Oh, no.
Yeah, citizens don't like this, and they kind of send him packing off the bench.
Right.
Now, President Grant is in office, and his second administration is plagued by scandals. His Secretary of War resigns because of these scandals. Grant needs help. He needs an honest man. He's familiar with Alfonso. He's a fellow Ohioan. He's a Republican. He's a jurist. He calls Alfonso to Washington and offers him the post Secretary of War. Alfonso accepts, and then 2 months later, Grant promotes Alfonso to become Attorney General of the United States. Grant's term is over, and Alfonso comes back to Cincinnati, resumes his law career with his sons, who are now young attorneys. Chester Arthur takes over the presidency upon the assassination of James Garfield. President Garfield was an attorney here in Cincinnati for many years, was a personal friend of Alfonso's, and had dinner in his house on several occasions.
Right.
President Arthur offers Alfonso the ministership to Austria-Hungary. So Alfonso's wife and daughter go off to Vienna. He's in that post for 2 years, and then he's given a promotion, minister to Russia, court of the Tsar, and they move to St. Petersburg. Now, the boys are back here in Cincinnati watching their father. He never says no for a request to do public service. Now, the desk in the corner, one of the few pieces we do have from the Taft family, was Alfonso's. When he became Secretary of War, he gave that to a work associate when they left town, and the family kept it. And when the house was being restored in the 1980s, it was obtained from the family.
That's a beautiful desk.
It is. It's very Masonic in origin. Alfonso was Masonic. Mm-hmm. You have the staircase going up, the mirror in the back for reflection of yourself, some hidden compartments. Very temple-like. You know, mm-hmm. Newspapers, again, are original. William's 8th birthday, September 15th, 1865. Mm-hmm. Then we have one of the few original photos we have of a 3-year-old future president hanging on the wall here.
He was really a cute little kid.
It's very Shirley Temple-esque with the dress and the curls.
Yeah.
We bring school kids in here and always make the kids guess who it is. And 99% of the time, that's little Fanny, the sister.
Mm-hmm.
And when you tell them who it is, you know, the girls giggle and the boys just stare in disbelief. And you have to explain to them the custom of the time period that all children were dressed alike. And dresses helped mom with diapers. They didn't have, you know, easy access. We have another one, the fireplace is painted. Alfonso is a man of technology. In 1866, gas lighting is installed in the house, and they have this portable gas brass lamp that they can move about the room. He installs a central coal furnace in the basement, but he vents the heat through the opening of all the fireplaces. The family has also read Darwin, Origin of Species, and have discussed it. Alfonso and Louise kind of move away from this conservative Christian Baptist upbringing, and they become Unitarians. They believe in a supreme being, but not in the divinity of Christ or the Trinity. And these are the values that get instilled into their children. It's a concept of deeds over creeds. If you live your life correctly and do the right thing, you shouldn't have to worry what faith you're a member of. This becomes a key issue in Will's campaign in 1908. How can you be president if you don't believe in Jesus Christ? Will does not back down. He defends his Unitarianism. But he also states that Christianity is the foundation of Western civilization, and a religious upbringing, no matter what faith, raises one's character to a higher level. Now, Charlie, his older brother, has this newspaper with a wire service system. Charlie is able to take all of Will's ideas, publish them, send them out across the country to convince the conservatives that Will is the correct man to be president, even though he's running on progressive coattails of Teddy Roosevelt. Will easily takes the White House in 1909. The Republican Party splits in 1910 over several key issues, tariff being one of them. Roosevelt, who had crowned Taft his successor, had gone off to Africa to get out of the way. He comes home and says, "What has happened? The party has split between my progressives and the Speaker of the House, Joe Gannon, conservatives. And all you've done is kind of sat there and let this happen." Taft believed in the letter of the law. And he didn't feel his goal was to get involved with Congress, but to steer a steady course for the presidency. Roosevelt doesn't like this approach, and he decides to run against his best friend for the 1912 nomination.
We have to pause there. That is a huge thing. As you just said, Taft was sort of T.R.'s anointed choice to succeed him.
Correct.
T.R. had declared he was not going to run for a third term.
Right.
Exactly. And I think he regretted that.
He did. Like Bush's famous words, no new
tax. Exactly. No third term, right.
Yeah.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm having a great time with my buddy Dennis from the National Historic Site of the Taft family, the famous Taft political family of Cincinnati, Ohio. And I've just been learning so much stuff. And one of those things was about the intense friendship and the intense rivalry between Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft. After the break, we'll come back and we'll finish our tour, so stick around. Now it's time to finish our tour of the Taft family home at the Taft National Historic Site in beautiful downtown Cincinnati. Now, one thing that we've learned about Taft today that I happen to know, but maybe you didn't, was that President William Howard Taft was our only president who also served as the Chief Justice of the United States. We'll get to that in just a minute or two. But before we get there, we have to finish the poignant story of how Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft had a great falling out. It seems that Teddy had wanted William Howard Taft to follow him into the White House, but then after having disappeared for a few months in a safari to Africa, T.R. came back, and then things started going south pretty quickly.
This was a great break, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. They talked throughout those first year that Roosevelt came back from Africa. But, the relationship fell apart rather quickly.
And that was about 1910 or 11, right, or somewhere in the middle of Taft's term.
Yeah, about 1910 it started when Roosevelt came back, and then through 11 and 12, just totally deteriorates.
Right.
In fact, the president's wife, often said, I told you to watch out for Teddy, because she didn't trust him. Helen did not trust T.R. at all, although they were friends while they were, you know, Secretary of War.
And you already said Helen really wanted to be First Lady.
She really wanted to be
enjoyed
First Lady.
That.
Yeah, she enjoyed that. Unfortunately, Helen, you know, to digress here, she becomes First Lady, and 3 months into the White House, she suffers a serious stroke and becomes incapacitated. She was Will's best advisor. She, in my mind, she could have been our first woman president. She was well qualified. Growing up, she said she was going to rely on no man for her livelihood. She got her own education. She smoked, she drank, she gambled. She knew
what's not to love.
Yeah, she knew who she was about, you know, and she was his best advisor. She read people better than Will did. She understood the issues and their implications better than he does.
Right.
And he confided in her. When she becomes inflicted with this stroke, he will not bring any issues to her. But he works with her every night so that she can regain her speech and her physical ability. Oh. So he's lost his best advisor. I really believe if she wouldn't have had the stroke, the presidency would have had a whole different course.
Really?
Yeah. And that's my own opinion and everything that I've read.
Sure.
Although she probably wouldn't admit to it. She wasn't a woman suffragette, you know, by any means. But, you know.
Right. The power behind the throne, so
exactly.
to speak. Well, that is very sad. So she had a stroke very early on.
She does recover.
Right.
Oh, I'd say 90% of it recovers, and she suffers a second stroke, a little less severe in the White House, but she does enjoy the rest of the White House years.
Okay. But then T.R. comes back, then things go south.
Yeah,
and
go
what
sour.
Happens in 1912?
1912, you know, the convention's in Chicago again, and Will's nominated as, you know, the nominee for the Republican Party, and T.R. is upset. The progressives don't like this. In fact, they're trying to shout down the election of Will or the nomination of Will. So they take their group and go down the street and nominate Teddy Roosevelt for the progressive nominee, and he takes on the moniker of the Bull Moose, you know, because he's as strong as a bull moose after getting shot in a campaign speech.
That's a story in and of itself. He got shot during a speech and was saved because the bullet struck something in his pocket.
Notebook, a wallet or something.
You know, it might have been a copy of his speech or something,
yeah, yeah.
Right? But it still penetrated to some extent. So there he is with blood running down
his
chest.
Speech.
And he just said, no, I'm going to give my speech.
Yeah.
And then he was asked, how do you feel? I feel as strong as a bull moose. And that was what they called the party thereafter.
Yep. And so during that election, you know, they split the Republican ticket and the Democrat Woodrow Wilson takes the White House. If you look at the vote, though, Taft comes in a very distant third.
Mm.
So if Taft would have dropped off, Roosevelt may have been elected to a third term. Hmm. And if Roosevelt wouldn't have run, I believe Taft probably would have won his third or second term of office.
Yeah, you split the vote like that. I mean, well, it's now 2016, and people are talking about the same thing with the possible third-party bid by Donald Trump or Dr.
Carson.
Carson, right. And that could have the same effect this year as happened back in 1912.
Taft actually and Roosevelt become bitter enemies. They no longer talk. Taft's whole goal, he knows he's going to lose the White House, but his goal is to stop Roosevelt from getting the deed, too.
Oh, they really had fallen out then.
They had fallen out completely.
I'm just not going to let TR take it.
That's right.
Okay.
He didn't care. You know, and they see each other after the election. Of course, Wilson's in the White House. They meet each other once at a funeral, shake hands, and just acknowledge each other and go their separate ways. But a year before Roosevelt dies, Taft is in Chicago in a hotel, and he goes into the elevator, and he says, take me up to the room, and the doorman for the elevator says, Mr. Roosevelt's having lunch down in the restaurant. And Taft right away says, take me down. He goes right into the restaurant. Now, the whole country knows what has happened between these two men. They see Taft go right up to Roosevelt and shake hands and sit down, and the whole restaurant stands up and applauds.
Wow.
You know, because they're talking. They talk for about a half hour. We have no record of what they talked about. T.R. dies the following January. Taft goes to the funeral and cries like a baby.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that story. That's very moving. I think they still loved each other in some sense.
No, they did. I think they just built a wall that they couldn't tear down, you know, publicly, so to speak.
Right. Yeah, they didn't have, I mean, Adams and Jefferson had a similar falling out, but they reconciled and had the blessing of a number of decades of life during which they could write each other. But at least Taft and Teddy Roosevelt had a brief reconciliation there before.
I always like to compare it to, I always look at Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter had this great relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Clinton and George Bush, the first Bush, H.W. had this great relationship. And they're from different political spectrums, but their terms were right back to back with each other.
Right.
And how I think this hindsight is, we had the same problems.
It's a very small club, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
You know, and there are very few people you can talk about being president with. And I imagine there would be a certain kinship
even with bitter political rivalry. You know, once a rivalry's gone, there's no point in holding grudges.
Exactly.
Right? Well, that is a pretty moving story.
During the Wilson years, he does become somewhat friends with Wilson. He backs Wilson for the League of Nations. Mm-hmm. He's a big proponent of that, even though the Republican side is looking at him and says, you're Republican, we're opposed to it, but you're in favor of it. He really believed in international court of law could determine, you know, how the world would run safely.
Mm-hmm.
Wilson's term is over, and Harding wins the presidency. And Will had campaigned for Harding, and there was a conversation between the two about, you know, if you become president and there's an opening on the court, am I eligible? Would you consider me? And they go back and forth and kind of have an understanding. Harding takes office, and several months later, Chief Justice Edward White dies. And, of course, Will, right away, there's a note to Harding saying, kind of, you promised me, you know, mm-hmm. we have an understanding. And Harding acknowledges that and promotes or nominates Will to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
you know, in Harding's first year in office. And it's a job that Will covets. You know, this is the top of his life, you know. And he serves on the court almost 8 years, longer than he's president. And he does more for, I think, the country under those 8 years than he does 4 years as presidency. Although his presidency is not well looked at because he's between Roosevelt and Wilson, two giants, and they both had big issues. Will didn't have a lot of issues. But as president, what Will does, he does more land conservation, he does more trust busting, he does the income tax, federal income tax, the U.S. budget system, mm-hmm. he develops all that. But what he does, what Roosevelt did everything by executive order, which we're hearing a lot about today with Obama, an executive order, how it's not good.
Mm-hmm.
Taft wants to codify everything. So everything Taft does goes through the legislature, so it is law, so it can't be taken away.
He sounds like a man who very much believes in the rule of law.
That's his life.
That's his life, and that's why he likes the whole idea of international courts of justice.
Exactly.
And all the rest of it. Judges should be in charge.
Yes, and he takes it to such a level, even in his personal life, and a great story is he loved to golf. He golfed every day that he could.
Mm-hmm.
And he was up at his summer home in Murray Bay, and this is after the presidency when he's Chief Justice. And he's on the tee, and he's standing in front of his ball, but he's in front of the tee boxes instead of behind them on his shot. And the president of the club comes running out and says, stop. I know you're past president, current chief justice, but the rules of golf say you should stand behind these boxes when you're teeing off. President just slowly stands up and says, sir, this is my second shot. So he followed the letter of the law in everything he did. I'm sure he was an honest scorekeeper.
Right, I'm sure he was. No mulligans for
yeah.
Taft.
He shot in the 90s for 18, I do know that.
Wow, I guess that's pretty impressive.
Yeah. But it was his exercise. But, you know, when he gets to the court, he sees the court a mess. The court is hearing every case that comes through the judicial system. You know, they're backed up. There's a backlog of cases to be heard. And Taft says, this is not right. We need to, you know, whittle this down somehow. So the three things he does on the court is, one, he gets the whole federal judiciary reorganized to fall under the Chief Justice so that they can look at where the caseloads are heavy or weak and they can switch them around. There's some organization to the federal judiciary. The second thing he does, he gets Congress to rewrite the law that says the court has the right of certiorari, where they can hear cases they want to hear that pertain to national issues or constitutional issues. They don't want to hear cases about petty larceny, and, you know, all these other prohibition cases that can be handled by lower courts. The third wonderful thing he does, he gets the Supreme Court building built, because they do not have a facility. They're meeting in the old Senate chambers in the Capitol building.
In the basement.
Okay. And he feels the court needs its own place to stand among the other two branches of government.
And it was Taft who got that going.
Taft got that going, got the federal government. He never sees the building being built, or he sees it being started, but he doesn't see it finished. He dies in 1930, and the building, I think, is dedicated in 32 or 33.
Right.
I'm not exactly
sure. A lot
sure
of people don't realize that. I mean, the front facade, especially, I guess it's the west facade of the court.
Yes.
Is the one that, you know, people see on television all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, that looks just as imposing as the Capitol building or the White House in its own way. And they don't realize that that's only what, I guess, that makes it about 80 years old now.
Yeah.
Maybe 90 or getting close. Yeah.
One of the stories I liked, you know, we talked about when we were in the introductory room about the tiles around the fireplace and the tortoise and the hare, which was very influential in his life because he always felt the law was slow and steady. Well, if you go to the back of the Supreme Court building in the frieze above, the tortoise and the hare are carved into the corners.
I did not know this.
Yeah.
And I also like that. That is such a cool story.
I like to think that Taft had some influence on that.
Uh-huh. But well, I don't doubt it.
Yeah, but it's...
I mean, he's the guy who's building the building. Why wouldn't he... He's probably looking at the architectural plans.
I don't know if that's true. I've never read anything about it. But when I actually walked back there and I saw it, I said, this has got to be related to
We're simply going to believe it.
It's Aesop's fable. I mean, it's a classic one, you know.
Tremendous.
So anyways, when he gets to the court, you know, he does help clear up the bench. He believes in unanimity on the court. He wants everybody to vote together to make the court have more presence. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't succeed in that because the court is kind of divided. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got conservatives, he's got liberals, and he can't get them all on the same page. And people keep switching on him sometimes, but he's a very good administrator on the court.
Right.
And his cohorts, you know, or colleagues on the court, when he resigns, they send him a very nice letter that they think of him as the court, you know, that he's done his job well.
And he resigned
February 3rd, 1930.
So just, and then he died when again?
March 8th, 1930.
Oh, so he hung on as long as he could.
He hung on as long as he could, yeah.
What finally got him?
Arterial sclerosis. You know, he carried all this weight all those years. I mean, he was a healthy person. He golfed every day. He horsebacked. He was an avid baseball player and a fan of baseball.
Right.
I mean, it just, I believe that weight.
Right.
And, of course, the time.
He just liked to eat.
Well, you know, he liked it. We know he was an anxiety eater, and mashed potatoes were his favorite food.
Oh, man. Okay, that'll do it to you.
Yeah. But when he gets to the White House, he actually goes on a celebrity diet. You know, they get him down to, like, 250 during his White House years, and he doesn't eat a lot. And he sticks to his regimen pretty well. I mean, he's not shoving candy and chips in his mouth every day, I think.
Right.
He's very conscious. He follows.
Yeah, I'd heard that he was very conscious of this and conscious of the criticism, which could be cruel sometimes.
Yeah.
And people even made up those stories. And, you know, don't get mad at me. I have to ask, though. Go ahead and debunk that story about the bathtub.
Classic story. He is a big gentleman. He does have custom furniture made when he goes and travels and places. But when he gets to the White House, he needs a larger bathtub. He does not get stuck in it. That's the big
lie, yeah.
You know, but there is a bathtub that's made for him, and four men do fit into it. In fact, upstairs in the gallery, we have a picture of that with the four men in it.
Right.
But, you know, he was also self-evasive, I think, about his weight. You know, he told stories on himself. There's a great one when he was a Superior Court judge here in the Midwest. He was in a little town waiting for the train to pick him up. And the train master comes out and says, the train does not stop here, only for large parties. He wires ahead to the train, says, please stop, there's a large party waiting for the train. The train stops, says, where's the large party? He goes, I'm it, and he gets on board.
Oh, but there was one more thing, Dennis, wasn't there? You're having an anniversary this year, aren't
you? Yeah, the National Park Service is celebrating this year, 2016, the 100th anniversary of the foundation of the parks. And one of the goals of the National Park Service is to get every fourth grader to a national park, because we believe this is the future of the Park Service and of the heritage and history of this country.
So, well, I completely support you. I love the national park system. I love you guys. You all, I've talked to a lot of NPS people. You're all wonderful. And you're a volunteer.
I'm a volunteer here.
So you're doing this out of the goodness of your heart.
Yeah, and I have to admit, you know, this is one of the best things I've ever done in my life, is meeting visitors and giving them my information about the president, the history of this country, and, you know, how history keeps repeating itself, and we never learn from it.
Well, we're going to try to fix that. So if you're a fourth grader, you need to get to a National Park Service site, and if you need your mom and dad's help, well, then ask
them.
There's
free passes for fourth graders.
There's free passes for fourth graders this year, and we strongly encourage you especially to come to the Taft Historic Site right here in Cincinnati because, well, there's even more stuff here we didn't even have a chance to get to. So thanks again, Dennis.
You're welcome.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to the National Park Service volunteer, Dennis Solovsky, who took us all the way to the Taft National Historic Site. And thanks also to his boss, Kerry Wood, through whom I arranged this wonderful tour. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howell of James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment, even if you're carrying a few extra pounds on you.